Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Carlotta Gall covers Afghanistan for the New York Times. Her new book is entitled The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014. Highly critical of Pakistan, it offers new information about how Islamabad has helped the Taliban in Afghanistan and how Pakistan's intelligence agency may have helped Osama bin Laden hide out in Abbottabad, Pakistan. Joe Donahue spoke recently with Carlotta Gall about whether or not there is a narrative timeline for the war.
Well, I think when you're there, you're running around doing individual news stories, and it's always stop and start. But this is really why I wrote the book, because after 10 years was when I first started thinking about it, and now 12 years, you see the themes that you realize were always there, and you reported on them early on, and yet somehow people forget, or people have lost their way, or don't see it anymore. So I really felt the need to put down the whole narrative, as you say, to show that from the beginning there were some things that were going wrong from the Pakistani side, to help the Taliban stage this resurgence, then build such an insurgency that it was actually killing thousands of people, Afghans and foreign servicemen who were fighting there, and then trace it right back to the source, which was the core of the problem in Pakistan, where as I show, the Pakistani military were actually managing and orchestrating this insurgency. So when you spend so long, you do find the whole narrative is worth tracking and putting down all in one piece in a book, and that's why I did it.
The title of the book is The Wrong Enemy. What should we take from that title?
That for many years, when I say we, I mean American forces and NATO forces and the whole international Western world, if you want, were fighting in Afghanistan and often expending a great deal of energy on the villages of Afghanistan and the villagers, people living there, when in fact that was treating the symptom of the disease, where the real source of the problem was where it was coming from, which was the radicalization of people and the Taliban in Pakistan, in the madrasas, the recruitment of young men, the running of training camps, the mixing with the Al-Qaeda remnants who'd also come out of Afghanistan and were harbored in the tribal areas along the border. And then the headquarters of the Pakistani military who masterminded this whole thing. And instead of being allies of America, they've really been pretense allies, but actually working against the whole mission in Afghanistan.
We were speaking about this on the air the other day, and you mentioned it in the book, and I think it is something that is paramount to the story, and that is the death toll. There is a tremendous amount of lives lost and blood shed in this 13-year period of time.
Yeah, terrible. I mean, I try. Nobody knows how many Afghans have died, but obviously we know the soldiers who've died, and it's over 3,000 American soldiers in the whole Operation Enduring Freedom in the region. And I think tens of thousands of Afghans, I put the figure between 50 and 70,000 over 10 years, well, 12 years now. So really a very high toll. Pakistanis have also suffered. I'm not so sure of the figures. There are official figures which I don't quite trust, but still, it's still tens of thousands of Pakistanis. So, yeah, a terrible toll for something that I think shouldn't have happened, because if you remember back in 2001, the Taliban were defeated very quickly, and we shouldn't have let it slide from then to build into something that still threatens Afghanistan today.
Just staying with the death toll for a moment, you also talk about the death toll for journalists, for those covering this story in both Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yes, and that is, of course, very close to heart, because their colleagues and people you know and you've worked with who've been hit. And it's actually worse in Pakistan than in Afghanistan. For many years, Afghanistan journalists manage to work. Now we have had a number killed in recent years, especially just recently a great friend, Sardar Ahmed, with his entire family, two of his three children, and his wife gunned down in a hotel in Kabul. But in Pakistan, it's now, I think, it's over 42 have been killed in the last 10 years in the course of doing their profession, of exercising their journalism. So that is a very grim statistic. It puts Pakistan in among the worst countries in the world for journalist deaths. And what I found as well is there's a great deal of intimidation from the authorities, from the intelligence services, of journalists. So they're frightened to report on things. They're warned off from reporting things. And if they do continue, they can meet their death. So very, very tough.
One of the things that I learned in your book that I think you illustrate is the relationship between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And I'm hoping you can touch on that for a moment about that relationship between the two countries and how it's changed.
Well, that's the sad thing, because, you know, one of the great statistics, I mean, terrifying of the Russian period, when the Russians invaded Afghanistan in the 80s, millions of Afghans fled the country because the bombing was so horrendous. And so 5 million Afghans, which was a third of the population, left Afghanistan and went to Pakistan and Iran. And Pakistan took them in with barely a murmur. It was just, of course, you know, there was no question that they would shelter them and help them. And, you know, refugee camps sprung up. And, of course, the international world helped. But Pakistan hosted them, and they still are hosting them. Some of them have never gone back, and, you know, now it's almost 30 years. So in one sense, they're real brothers. They are like one people. They have ethnic Pashtuns on both sides of the border, which is partly why that is they are so close. And yet you have this other side where Pakistan has been running a sort of colonial war of aggression against Afghanistan in order to control it. They want a client state. They want a pliant government in power in Kabul that they control, or they have a great deal of influence over. And so for that reason, Pakistan has always run this proxy force, which was the Mujahideen, then became the Taliban, and still is the Taliban, in order, as an instrument of foreign policy, in order to annex even or control Afghanistan. And that is a far from brotherly undertaking. It's something that Admiral Mullen, the American, the former Joint Chiefs of Staff, said, you know, was against international norms and possibly warranted sanctions. So it's an extreme aggression. At the same time, when the people-to-people contacts are still very brotherly.
You also write about the relationship between Pakistan and the United States, with Pakistan receiving a lot of money and assistance from the U.S.
Yes, and they still do. And that's the extraordinary relationship between America and Pakistan, because supposedly allies in the war on terror, yet I've shown how it was clear that Pakistan was running an insurgency that was actually trying to kill and attack American forces and undo the mission, I mean, you know, in Afghanistan to destroy and break the state and the mission that the foreign forces were trying to build. There's obviously a distrust build, you know. The United States understands a bit of what's going on. So when they do the raid on bin Laden, they don't tell Pakistan. So they do it as a covered operation without telling the host nation, because they didn't trust Pakistan. And so then that's very clear. Pakistan is shown to be harboring bin Laden. And yet now the relationship is back to the same old game of being polite about Pakistan and trying to preserve the relationship. So it's very confusing to me and to a lot of Afghans and Pakistanis too.
When you talk about relationships, let's talk about President Hamid Karzai for a moment. You write in the book that when Karzai was forced to admit that he had failed to win the first round of elections, this is 2009, you write, quote, "I watched Karzai's face that day in the palace with John Kerry. I knew he would not forgive America for the humiliation."
And I don't think he has. I think a lot of Karzai's comments, you know, he's now become quite famous for his anti-American comments, his sort of difficult way of dealing with them, his refusal to sign this bilateral security agreement that's all prepared and ready, and he won't sign it. All these things, I think, stem from that. It was a sense of betrayal. He felt America was turning against him, trying to replace him in the election with another leader, and he felt betrayed after all that he'd done and all the things they'd done together. And I think there's a sort of sense of pique as well, you know, when you're in power for so long, you become more vain and more full of yourself. And so I think he can't bear criticism so easily. And I think he won't forgive America for that humiliation. And I think it's damaged the relationship very, very gravely.
So what does that mean for an Afghanistan without American troops on the ground?
Well, I think, I mean, for starters, we've just had new elections. They'll probably go to the second round, but I think whoever wins the new election, Karzai has to step down. They will probably sign the agreement. All the front runners have said they will sign the agreement, the security agreement. I think they will insist on good relations with the U.S. going forward, and I think the United States wants that. So even though the relationship is damaged, I think it could be quickly patched up and renewed under a new leader. Having said that, the withdrawal of troops is going ahead, and at this stage, the new leader will only be able to, salvage what is already happening, which is the drift away from Afghanistan of the West. That if the troops go, inevitably the aid, the assistance programs will wind down, the diplomatic leverage will dissipate, and there'll be less of an interest. You know, people will be turning to other countries of greater import. You know, whether it's Ukraine or Syria or the Middle East or whatever. So that's the trajectory for Afghanistan, that they are going to see a dwindling of interest and support. And that is very, very worrying for Afghanistan. And many Afghans talk to me, and they are worried, even people on Karzai's, you know, staff in the palace. They're very worried about that because they know they're still weak and they're still at prey of their neighbors, in particular Pakistan, which is still set on dominating the region and dominating Afghanistan, and in a very aggressive way is using, you know, guerrilla forces in the form of the Taliban to commit, you know, not only an insurgency, but real terrorism with car bombs and very damaging attacks. So that is very worrying for Afghanistan, and I think they are actually going to need all the help they can get. And I think the next leader, when he's finally voted in and inaugurated, will be making that a priority, is to keep the West friendly and helpful, because it's going to be another tough decade for Afghanistan.
The name of the book is The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014. Karwata Gal, thank you so much for spending time with us. I do appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Again, the title of the book is The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.